Yeah, I can hear you now. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Okay, good.
I'm not sure what the hell was happening here, man. Sorry about that.
No, it's grand. It's grand. In fact, it's probably my fault. I've been having one of those weeks. Nothing works whenever I touch it. And when I do get something moving, it's moving in the wrong direction. So
I don't know. You can't be blamed for this. It was my Zoom that wasn't working.
How these things work. You don't have far reaching.
Goes all the way to the top.
Did you ever hear that joke about the conspiracy theorist who dies and goes to heaven and God meets him and is showing him around and he says, okay, right, well, tell me, God, who is the one man controlling it all? And God goes, I'm sorry to tell you, there's no man controlling it all. And the guy stops and goes, Jesus Christ, this goes all the way to the top.
Nice one. So you're very welcome to this week's episode of the Swap Meet podcast. My name is Danny O'Hanlon.
My name is Niall McCann.
And we had all sorts of technical issues here at the start. Zoom just was like, nope. I don't know what I did to upset it, but it just wasn't happening. Zoom pretty much buried Skype, didn't it? I feel like at the start of the pandemic, Zoom just sort of showed up and was like, oh, the new game in town all of a sudden. And Skype just seems to have disappeared.
It's a fickle world, Dan, and everybody has to be on the new thing now these days.
Yeah. Can you remember like a technological thing? Like, I know what it is for me, and that's why I'm asking, where you just drew the line and you were like, no, I don't know. I don't know what this is about. I don't know why I need it. For me, it was Snapchat.
Ah, exact same one.
I was just like, I don't know what this is. I don't know what people use it for. I don't know why I need it. No, thank you.
I know what people use it for.
Well, it's dick pics mainly, like, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I can do them quite well enough on WhatsApp, thank you.
I don't have cause to pick my dick, you know, so it's like, it's an app that's of no use to me whatsoever. It was where I drew the line where I was like, no, this is like, I need a fucking hovercraft more than I need this, like, you know.
I downloaded it and it was on my phone for about half an hour one night. And I just thought, I don't understand. I'm not doing it. Nobody needs it. Shouldn't want it. There's TikTok now.
Yeah, I don't know what TikTok. I know people dance on it. That's all I know about it, really. Like, you know, it's easy. A lot of dancing.
A lot of dancing and a lot of Chinese spying. This episode is going to collapse now. We're going to be targeted by the People's Republic of China or whatever they call it.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, Dan, invite it. You can take it to the bank. Like.
You can cash that.
Nothing strange.
Nothing really.
This will be a fun episode, won't it?
It was a roasting week and a half or whatever it was, like, you know.
It was beautiful. I loved it.
We took the marquee that Kat uses for markets and set it up out in the garden. So we were like, literally, like, when it got too hot, we could go in the shade and we were just eating all our meals outside and stuff. It was great.
Oh,
like,
you lovely.
Know, it was a real shame to take it down. I was like, oh, bollocks. This is kind of the life, you know.
I bought about, because I wasn't eating. I found for a while I wasn't eating. In the evenings, I'd just be like, oh, I can't face food. So I bought about 3.5 weeks worth of tomatoes and buffalo mozzarella and pesto.
Nice.
Yeah, it is nice. It is nice when the weather's like that. And then the weather broke the next day, so now I have a fridge full of this shit. And it's freezing. And I'm eating fucking Italian summer food.
Well, what you do is, Niall, I don't know whether you're the kind of lad who would get a bit of dough on the go, but you could make yourself some pizzas, or you could buy some ready-made pizza bases, and you could. That's how you use that up.
Suffer it through. Suffer it through. Just eat. Just chill.
Suffering just through tomatoes and mozzarella and pesto.
I know. It's pretty grim. It's shame I can.
So were you able to get out and about in the heat at all, or were you working? Or
We went out to Chilling Hill one day, one evening. It was about 7 o'clock when we got there. It was packed. It's just black, full of people. And then I thought, that's different, because in my day there would have been a parent at home. And you would have spent the day down there at the beach. Then you would have headed home. But I think what was happening was that a load of folks were kind of getting home and heading out with the kids after work, you know?
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I never thought of it like that. But yeah, because
made me a bit sad, I have to say.
Yeah, because the cost of living is high. Like, in a family household with 2 or 3 kids, like, one wage isn't enough. It's not going to...
No.
It's just like... And it's ridiculous. Like, it's...
Yeah.
Like, life is so expensive. And it's because we're paying for a load of shit that we didn't need in the past. Like, you know? Like, in the past, you would... Even if you think of, like, you just have your television there and just by magic, channels would be on it, like, you know. Whereas now it's like, well, everyone has to have a device, and there's a, like, there's a computer, and you have to pay for the fucking the different, like, streaming things, like, and all that kind of gear, like, and I just there's a lot of money being frittered away on shit we don't need, like, you know. And you kind of feel like you need it in a way, you know. It's, life is very strange at the minute.
I'm paying for fucking Amazon.
You're flying Jeff Bezos to space. Well done.
I'm flying Jeff Bezos to, yeah, you're very welcome. And just recently, it started, loads of ads started coming up for films, like with Chris Pratt and Liam Neeson, and they're big sort of blockbustery films that you can watch on Amazon.
They're going to be the new studios, like, because I don't know who I was listening to being interviewed. I think it was Roger Avery, who's the bloke that co-wrote Pulp Fiction, who didn't get the proper credit. And he was saying that when you go to book locations for films now, there's certain locations that the likes of Netflix and Amazon just have booked up for years. They don't even know what they're going to use them for yet, but they just, there's so much money in those. If you think of, like, I remember getting Netflix when I was living in Galway and just thinking, people are going to fucking laugh at me when I tell them that I'm paying for this. Like, you know. And now it's like, it's one of the biggest studios on the planet, like, you know.
It struck me because I was getting all these ads for Amazon and shit, and for Amazon, these films, and they look massive, they look expensive. It's a summer blockbuster sort of slate, like you would have in a cinema, but they're doing it for Amazon.
I remember, like, I always say to Kat, like, when I first got Netflix, all I really would do with it was, like, if I couldn't sleep, I would go online and find, go onto Netflix, and there was bound to be some film with fucking Casey Affleck in a snow hat, like, you know, sitting on a swing or something in the winter. And I was it was always those kind of touchy-feely indie dramas that were on there. And I'd be like, all right, 20 minutes of this and I'll be out like a light, you know. Yeah. And he, you know, he's moved home and he's like, you know, for whatever reason, he's left Brooklyn and now he's living back home in Illinois or whatever, like, you know.
Did you see Manchester by the Sea?
No, I didn't see it actually, no.
Griffin, man, it's a tough watch. It's a grim watch now, but it's great. It's really good.
I don't have space in my life for grim watches anymore.
Well, you're right. There's so many fucking wonderful, colorful superhero films just doing the rounds that we talk up so much all the time. What do you want, Dan? What do you want? Blockbusters are stupid. Oh, I don't know if I have it in me to watch a grim drama.
Comedies. And those kind of things where old men sit in front of mixing desks, turning things up and down. Now, if you listen to the bass here, you'll notice that it sounds like shit. See, this is the thing. I always say, like, oh, I can't watch this, I can't watch that. I made 3 hours in my schedule to watch that fucking thing with Rick Rubin and Paul McCartney going through the Beatles tapes, and it was boring. It's all shit I've heard before, but it was like, I watched the whole thing. It was 3 hours long, like, you know.
You sent me that video of Paul McCartney's son, because I was giving out about, did I give out last time about Jacob Dylan refusing to talk about his father?
No, we were talking about Jacob Dylan for some other reason. No, you weren't giving out about him per se, but I think you texted me after you listened to him on Joe Rogan, and you asked, like, are Jacob Dylan and his dad okay?
But they were talking about all these sort of 60s luminaries, and I think he's a kind of a U2 head. He kept bringing up U2, but he was talking about all these 60s luminaries, and they were like, you see, if you're like some great 60s folk icon and you have a huge repertoire of songs, people just want to hear the classics, you know, like and
struggling for a name,
and he goes, like, Joni Mitchell. And I was like, fuck off. I love Joni Mitchell, but Jesus Christ, it's obvious what's happening here. You're just, it's required that nobody mention your father.
Back in the day, he wanted to do WTF, and Marc Maron said, I'm not doing it if I can't talk about Bob, because it's just going to come up. I'm not going to be able to help myself. And he apparently, he said, look, if that means you don't want to do it, that's fine, that's okay, but I'm not doing it if we can't talk about your dad. And eventually he kind of came back and said, okay, look, I'll make an exception, kind of thing. So there's a bit in the interview where they're talking about something, I don't know what it is, and Mark kind of goes, well, you know, your old man kind of did something like that. And then Jacob was like, all right, okay, go on, what questions do you have, like, you know. And you could tell it was a real fucking hardship for him, like, you know. But it's the only time he's done it,
but I can see it now. And it was that video of Paul McCartney's son. What's your favorite album? let it be.
Oh, it's the worst. Oh, it just, I felt so bad for him because it's just like, no,
yeah.
you're supposed to think your dad's pathetic. Like, you know, you're not supposed to like, yeah, all his stuff is the best. It's influenced me no end. Like, I'm sure it has, but Jesus Christ, mate, do you not have a Beck album or something you could be talking about? Like, instead of just Abbey Road.
It's still very artificial to have a don't mention him rule. There was a couple of moments in the Joe Rogan interview where I was like Bob, right? Obviously, you should be saying like Bob Dylan.
Do you ever see the speech of, because Jacob Dylan inducted Tom Petty into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he said that because he knew Tom Petty's daughter because Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were Dylan's backing band for a tour. And they would open up the show with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and then Dylan would come on and they would be Dylan's band, like, you know. But
deadly.
He said, like, and I met, what the fuck is her name? I can't think of her name now. Jane. No, Jane's his wife's
Shania?
Name. Shania Petty. And he just said, like, he's just like, that's so cool. Tom Petty's your dad. I can't believe that. You know, like, it's kind of funny because, like, obviously Bob Dylan is his dad. And he's mad into Johnny Cash. He doesn't like the later Johnny Cash stuff with the sort of bare bones acoustic arrangements. I heard him on an interview. It was probably that one with Marc Maron, and he said that they just made him sound weak. And I knew him in real life, and he wasn't weak. He was like a fucking mountain. Like, you know, he's just like, he just said those albums don't reflect the man I knew at all. Like, you know,
really. So he would prefer Give My Love to Rose to Hurt.
Well, I find Hurt very hard to listen to. I'm just going to say it. I think it's a boring song. I think it's fuck all melody in it. It's really fucking dreary, both versions of it. Like, you know, I don't think it's a well-written song. I don't think it's good, you know.
Oh, Dan, what about his cover of One? One's a well-written song.
Yeah, I don't like his cover of One very much because it's got all the fucking cool guitar parts that the Edge put in it are just gone. And it sounds like if someone had a house party, like, you know.
Oh, we can't all be Mary J. Blige, Dan. Well, what about My Own Personal Jesus?
Yeah, no, I like that. That's pretty good. And I like the some of the ones he wrote himself, like, there's a man going around taking names. You know that song? It's so hard for me to kick against the pricks. That one. I like that one.
That's and a what's great
the
song.
One, the one that Sting wrote. I hung my head. Early one morning, was time to kill. I borrowed Jeb's rifle and sat on the hill. I saw a low rider crossing the plain. I drew a bead on him to practice my aim. My brother's rifle went off in my hand. A shot rang out across the land. The horse he kept running, the rider was dead. I hung my head, I hung my head.
I was listening to fucking Jordan Peterson talking to Ian McGilchrist 3 days ago. And I've listened to that. For some reason, I've listened to that like 50 million times, that particular episode of the podcast. I think it's really interesting.
There's certain podcasts I've listened to a lot. Like, you know, it's weird to listen to a podcast again, but sometimes, I don't know, they're kind of nice if you like them. Like, you know, if you like it, you like it.
They just hit you. I've listened to the country music episode of Revisionist History like 50 million times. I think it's really interesting.
Is that Malcolm Gladwell's thing?
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard him on the Broken Record thing with Rick Rubin. Third mention of Rick Rubin tonight. What's going on?
But we fucking love Rick Rubin here on Swap Meet Dan.
I think he's actually kind of overrated, but he produced one of my favorite albums of all time.
Prick.
He produced Wildflowers by Tom Petty, which is like such a good album.
You had a fair road to Damascus about Tom Petty, didn't you? You hated Tom Petty. I remember arguing on this very podcast with you about Tom Petty back in the early days.
The albums my dad had still probably wouldn't be my favorite ones. He had the Full Moon Fever and Into the Great Wide Open. Those albums, like,
Into the Great Wide Open. That's a cool song.
There was something about it that was really mid-paced and it was really American. I think I was just, there was a lot of that Johnny finished and he started high school, you know, like, and there was just something about it where I was just like, who the fuck is this guy whining?
He
like,
is profoundly American, Tom Petty.
Yeah,
profoundly,
yeah, but I think everything in my life at that point was either British or Irish. Like, I didn't watch, I can't, all the stuff I liked was all sort of British and Irish stuff. I mean, I'm talking about when I was 9 or something, like, I was very young, like, and like Dad what? Had the, just stuff on, like, he was mad, and my dad was mad into U2, and he was mad into T-Rex. So when we had the Tom Petty tape in the car. Now, the car is also the first place I heard Neil Young. We'd Neil Young Unplugged, and I was like, who the fuck is this? This sounds great. Like, you know, like, I think they went to see him in Slane in 92. My dad, I remember Dad and Mom got some kind of last minute ticket the Saturday morning that Neil Young was playing Slane, and they had to rush to get a babysitter and go and see him. I mean, they brought me back, I didn't even know who he was, like, you know, but it just kind of stuck in my head, and they brought me back a t-shirt, like, and then there was Neil Young was on in the house then for the next couple of weeks nonstop, and sure, it fucking obviously blasted with me.
It leaves its mark, that kind of shit.
There was that, the big, what were the big things in our house during that time? The Roy Orbison album was pretty big, Mystery Girl.
Love Roy. Yeah. Roy Orbison was like the first album I ever listened to. Some Roy Orbison album, because I found like a record player in my nanny's house, my mom's mom's house, and there was some Roy Orbison collection. And I thought, this guy's cool.
Do you know that David Lynch was kind of responsible for Roy Orbison kind of coming back into the public consciousness a little bit, because not Twin Peaks, Blue Velvet had that song, A Jolly Colour Clown They Call the Sandman. They had that was on Blue Velvet, and they could, for some reason, the master was knackered, like the master recording of it, and they had to pay for Roy Orbison to, that's a re-recording of that song, they paid for him to re-record a load of his stuff. Actually, there's a good chance if you have a best of Roy Orbison in the house or whatever, there's a good chance they're re-recorded versions, but they did their best to stick to the
I close my eyes. Sorry, Dan. I'm not listening to you.
No, I know.
In my head, it's just, and drift away.
That was when CDs first came out. That was a mad thing that all these old sort of legacy acts were re-recording all their stuff. I think Roy Orbison might have been one of the first people to do it, but because they had the new digital recording, they got everybody back in, like Del Shannon and all. They were dragging all these people out of retirement homes to record their stuff. One of my favorite songs of all time, Runaway. It's such
who's
a good
gonna,
song.
You're going to get Del Shannon for that. Who else? Or a castrato. But they don't let you do that anymore, Dan. It's political correctness gone mad.
I'd love to be able to see, when I mess around with the guitar at home, I play that song a lot. But I can't jump from normal voice to falsetto and back again very easily, because it's like, I wonder, wah, 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 wah. See, when you get back to that, it's just, can you feel the change? When you go, wah, 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 wonder, you kind of switch back to your chest voice, and it's, I can't wonder, make the change very easily, like, you know.
No, see, apparently
staying,
I can't.
You're staying in your falsetto there.
Well, that's because my normal singing voice is like this, Dan. So it's a huge range I'd have to jump. And I wonder. Sorry, I'm getting. I don't know why I'm giddy now. When you clicked record, I could have slapped. I'm giddy now already. Why
yeah,
is
me
this?
Too. I was ready for the bed, like, and I'm exactly the same now. Yeah. But
fuck it, Del Shannon anyway. Dead now.
One of his other songs is one of my favorite tunes as well. This is my story, it's sad but true. You know that one?
No.
It's about a girl that I once knew. She took my love and ran around with every single guy in town.
Hey, hey,
whoa.
There's a whole sort of school of songwriting, of rock and roll songwriting, that was big for a blip.
Yeah, then, like Neil Sedaka, these kind of people, like, you know.
Yeah, the Beatles. Knock three times on the ceiling if you want me. It just vanished. The Beatles came and Dylan came and gone, like smoke in the wind. That Brill Building thing. Well, no, the Brill Building was a bit later, wasn't it?
The Brill Building was the 60s for sure, yeah. And there was a brief moment, although they probably were Brill Building songwriters. Like, I saw, was it Gene Pitney I saw being interviewed? He was another fellow, like 20, I think he wrote 24 Hours from Tulsa. I could be wrong about that. Maybe that was 24
Hours from Tulsa.
I saw him being interviewed, and that's, he said, it's like, I was only 24 hours from Tulsa.
Go on, anyway. Sorry, what was he saying?
He said that the year the Beatles came out, he said before they even got to America, he was like, I think he saw them on, he heard them on radio or got some British imports or something, and he was like, oh shit, this is going to be fucking massive. Like, you know, and he was even a little bit older by that point. He wasn't cool. He was just kind of a crooner. Like, and he commissioned an artist to paint portraits of the Beatles that he had the right to reproduce and sell. And for those few years, he made a killing selling Beatles posters.
That's a man who's able to move with the times. I love that. I love, I like Knock Three Times quite well enough. But I love, but that's, Save the Last Dance isn't actually the same kind of thing though, is it?
Doc Pomus wrote that song, who was either in a wheelchair at the time he wrote it, or was, he had some kind of, he was getting some kind of degenerative thing and he ended up in a wheelchair.
Oh my God. And he wrote Save the Last Dance.
This is what he wrote it for his wife before their wedding. And it was like, it was basically like saying, I know you're going to dance with people tonight, but save the last dance for me. That's was the inspiration for the song.
Oh my God. I didn't even know. I love that song. I didn't even know that.
He lived into a well old age, Doc Pomus, like, you know, but he was, yeah, when he got, by the time he got married, he was in a wheelchair.
Like that fucking guy who wrote fucking Gunsmoke in the Big Lebowski or whatever it was.
No, he
had a fucking wonderful life. Does he still write?
No, he has health issues.
But Lou Reed wrote a whole album about Doc Pomus after he died. Magic and Loss.
Fucking Jesus. That's what you want. You want New York's biggest pervert at New York's perviest time to do your fucking autobiography.
Lou Reed and lockdown taught me a very important lesson.
Lockdown means something different to Lou Reed. It's something you wear, Dan.
Oh yeah, yeah. It could be kind of,
I don't
like
know why
an S&M
I'm sneering
thing
at Lou Reed. I love Lou Reed is brilliant.
I listened in the first lockdown, I listened to pretty much Lou Reed's full back catalog. And I listened to all these albums that were, you know, it was given knowledge that, oh, these are shite, don't listen to these ones, these are rubbish or whatever. Like, and I heard a song off one and I was like, wait a minute, this is a great song and it's off this album that's supposed to be rubbish, like, you know. And I listened back to them all and I was like, this is a fucking lesson. Don't be listening to, like, I love reading criticism. I know these people who say like critics should all be put out of the work or whatever. I think that's bollocks. I like reading music criticism and cinema criticism.
Yes, but, Kevin Smith. Take note, Kevin.
but I also learned the lesson that not to take it as fucking gospel, like, you know, because I listened to Growing Up in Public and Rock and Roll Horror and all these albums that are supposed to be fucking terrible, and some of them are, but there might be two really good songs on an otherwise shitty album, like, you know.
Lest I should kill me for another drink. Let's drink to the last shot and the blood on the dishes in the sink. Blood inside the coffee cup, blood on the tabletop. But when you quit, you quit. But you always wish that you knew it was your last shot. When you quit. But you always wish that you knew it was your last shot.
And yeah, just kind of, and what I did since was I took all these artists like Lou Reed, Joni Mitchell, Dylan, a few of these, and I put their entire discographies into like a Spotify playlist, and sometimes I'll just hit shuffle on Joni Mitchell and just see what comes on.
Oh, nice one.
So like you hear these songs out of context from the supposedly quote-unquote shite albums that they're on. And sometimes if you hear them out of context and not after 8 songs you didn't really like that much, they kind of reassert themselves a little bit, like, you know.
Do you listen to John Creedon?
No, not because I don't like him, but just Sorry, I took a big gulp of beer there. Because I just never think to listen to him, to be honest.
No, he's on at a weird hour of the day, but sometimes if I'm in the car with Niamh, she'll listen to John Creedon. Like, she loves John Creedon. But sometimes if I'm in the car with Niamh, he will play weird shit like that. And you go, is that Joni Mitchell? And then it's like, oh, who was Joni Mitchell?
Great songwriters don't just stop being great songwriters. What happens is they get a bit older and they get a bit more complacent. And, you know, they'll just like put out albums that aren't their best. But you can't, every one of them can't be your best. Like, you know.
Are there not people who sort of had it and then it was gone?
Sort of, like, you could think of some really severe cases, like the likes of Syd Barrett and these kind of people who had like mental issues and stuff, but I mean, yeah. I can't think of anyone that just completely lost it and did one good thing and then never again. It might even be an economic thing that these things, their first album didn't do that well, so it was fucking back to the factory with them or whatever. Like, you know, so it's not always
to the glue factory.
Yeah, see, the poor songwriter's been melted down to make glue. And but it's not always like a question of someone losing it. It's economic stuff. It's all sorts of things, like, you know.
There's a cultural moment at play as well. Sometimes something just is what people were looking for, whereas a wee bit of an antidote to something that we're sick of. Kevin Smith again, actually. When you're not sick of that old thing, what seemed like the antidote doesn't really do it for you. You go back and look at Clerks now and you go, this is very rough.
Yeah.
But stylized sort of 80s cool. When you're sort of sick of that and you can't take anymore, sometimes rough is just exactly what the doctor ordered, but you can't go to it again, you know?
I don't think I can hand on heart say that I think Clerks is even good, you know, but I just remember seeing it. I saw it with Paddy at college and it was just like, I know they were in a shop, but it might as well have been the coffee dock in DKIT, like, you know, and it was kind of like, oh, I get this. It's lads killing time, you know, like, which is kind of what you do at that age, like, you know.
Trying to think of another one now. Harper Lee wrote To Kill a Mockingbird and then didn't write anything again after that.
But did she just not write anything again, or did she lose it? Like, did she try and write something, or did she just decide, well, one's enough for, you know, writing a book's hard?
She did that Go Set a Watchman just shortly before she died. She gave them permission to print it.
I remember it coming out, yeah.
Well, I didn't go near it because it was sort of supposed to be like an early draft of To Kill a Mockingbird. But Atticus Finch was sort of a more flawed character in it. And I don't think I want to read about a flawed Atticus Finch.
You need some of those figures, like Atticus. Like, Atticus Finch is a bit like Superman or something. Like, you know, you kind of need those...
Yeah, I conflate the two because I remember one time on Comic Book Resources, a discussion about Superman's favorite stuff. And I was like, Superman's favorite album, Superman's favorite film, Superman's favorite book. And I was like, well, there's no discussion. Now, people apparently didn't feel like I was the final authority on that and went on to discuss it at great length. But I was like, well, obviously, there's no discussion about this. It's got to be To Kill a Mockingbird. It's obviously his favorite book. I couldn't go to Go Set a Watchman because maybe Go Set a Watchman is brilliant. And maybe it's a deeper thing than To Kill a Mockingbird. But I just felt like Atticus Finch has value as Atticus Finch. I don't want him to be sort of grubby. You know,
then he's just another person,
just another bollocks.
There's enough of them.
Yeah, like, I fucking meet them every day. I am them every day. Listen, Dan, speaking of flawed individuals, for your sins, I got you to watch a documentary that I'm sure you didn't super love. It's a 2017 documentary on Netflix called Voyeur.
I received this letter in 1980 from a man named Gerald Foose, who decided he wanted to buy a motel for the express purpose of using it to watch everything that was being done in private.
It had a high-pitched roof. That's where I would build my observation platform. They couldn't hear me. They couldn't see me. That was exactly what I wanted.
I'm writing a story about him for The New Yorker. I'm a natural person to write about a voyeur because as a writer, I'm a voyeur myself.
Nobody ever will be able to do what I did.
I mean, Foose is really disturbed, a sociopath who just needed the attention.
I spent more than 25 years waiting to bring his story and him as a person into the public eye.
If I knew what I was going to feel, I'd have never done this.
Gerald Fuchs and I have a deal. That is, for me to tell the truth and him to live with it. Suddenly, this guy is forgetting what we've agreed to.
I think Gay and I are going to have a real problem.
What the hell does he think this is? Some kind of goddamn game?
They're trying to expose you as a hypocrite.
How do you know what they're thinking?
Because that's the way people are.
Did we hit a sore spot on you?
The story never ends. The story's never done.
A lot of reporters think when they leave the story, it's all over. Sometimes it's just beginning.
This journalist is writing...
Gaia Talese.
He was one of these guys who would go away. Like, he wrote a book about sort of sex in the 70s or something, didn't he? And he went and lived in a nudist colony for 6 months and wrote about it.
Writing all around him.
Apparently so. And then his wife broke up with him for reasons unknown. And then he...
Did she break up with him?
I think she did, yeah. They did not say that. I'm pretty sure they mentioned that in the film. He came back, he was on talk shows going on about how he, well, you can't write about these things if you're not involved. So, of course, I...
Yeah, but she was on them with him.
Oh, was she? Oh, maybe maybe I misheard something there.
I don't know if she did. You could absolutely be right. Maybe I missed a line somewhere, but... my impression was she stuck with him. She was definitely on the talk shows in the 80s with him about the sex book.
Oh, okay, okay. So, it was the 80s. I thought it was the 70s. But
well, I think it was 80. So, he was doing this shit in the 70s and then the book came out in 80 or 81.
But someone writes him a letter, right? Is it this guy who owns a motel reaches out to him and says, I've got this
Gerald
setup.
Gerald
Fuchs. He says, I've got this setup where I can literally watch people while they're in their rooms and they don't know I'm watching them. And he would do this all night. He had a series of tunnels going over the rooms in the motel and he had little grates.
Did you totally believe all that?
Well, this was the thing. Even though I enjoyed the documentary, and if spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen it, it turns out that the guy didn't own the motel at all.
Well, for some of the time he did.
He didn't own it for as long as he said he did. And then he had kept really detailed journals that didn't really correlate with dates that buildings were sold and this kind of stuff. It all didn't really match up. Which, does that mean he was just writing fake journals? What does that actually mean?
Well, the journals seemed to start at 66 and he didn't own the hotel until 69.
So it's just wishful thinking up until then.
Well, the journals kept going until 88 and he didn't own the hotel after 1980. So there's also one really extraordinary story where apparently somebody got murdered in the hotel and he witnessed it, but there's no record of anyone getting murdered. There's no record of a body showing up. It doesn't mean it didn't happen, but they did say they called the police and stuff. His story did include them calling the police, the cleaning woman finding the body and him sort of going through the rigmarole with the police. And there doesn't seem to be a record of that. Like you say, it doesn't mean it didn't happen, but I wonder how much of it is fantasy.
I was engaged with it for sure. I was enjoying it. Enjoying is a weird word to use, but I was, but by the end of it, I kind of thought, well, what's the takeaway here? There wasn't much of a payoff to it. Do you know what I mean? It was just it just sort of petered out a little bit. And I was just kind of going, oh, the guy who wrote the book disowned the book when it came out it was only after the book was released that he found out that there was a discrepancy between the dates that this bloke said he owned the hotel and the dates he actually did. And he said, oh, well, the guy who owned it let me freaking wander about in corridors above there and spy on people, which I find very hard to believe.
He said, look, I didn't want to mention that because this guy was a voyeur and I don't want to get him in trouble, but he's dead and now I have to defend the book, so I will tell you that this is what happened. It's also a very convenient excuse. It's a weird one. I mean, I don't think 3/4 of the shit he was talking about happened.
Yeah, this is why it was kind of strange. Because then the writer disowns the book and then he goes on Seth Meyers and re-owns it. And then he says, oh, well, it doesn't matter or whatever. And then...
Re-owns is a real countdown word, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, I've got a 3. What am I going to do? Oh, wait, I can make it a 5. I can make it a 5.
The Washington Post did an interview with you where they had found some inconsistencies in his story as far as the years he owned the hotel.
Yeah.
You even say in the book that you can't vouch for everything he said. You call him out as an unreliable narrator. Do you think it's fair, then, for the Washington Post to call you out for getting facts wrong?
Well, it might be self-serving in the way I sound, but I'm not trying to be self-serving. The Washington Post is wrong. When I first got this news, I was broadside. I mean, I'm 84 now, but most of my life, from the time I was 20, I was a very careful reporter. I'm still a careful reporter. And they said, the Washington Post said, that during a period, this guy owned this motel for 37 years, for about 6 or 7, 8 years, from 1980, that's when after I left him, until about 86 or so, he didn't own the motel. Meaning, how can you not own the motel and try to write about as if you're in the motel? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that, and I was very upset, and I said, well, I can't go along and support this book. But the next day, I called the guy who bought the motel from the motel guy that I knew, and he said, no, I bought this motel from Gerald Foose, the guy, but he still had access to it. He had the key, and he had the key all the way through the owners. Then he rebought the motel in 86. If I had known that day I was told about this what I know now or what I knew the next day, I wouldn't have disavowed the book. That was a mistake in my part, but I overreacted. I was very angry and very embarrassed, too, because I took pride always in my life, reliable reporter. That's what I am. And I wasn't what the Post said. But I don't blame the aggressiveness of reporters in trying to check the facts, because we all try to do that.
There might be a bit of voyeur in me, I have to say. I just found it kind of interesting. I found the two of them very interesting.
I like that he was mad into his suits. Like, he was a very well-dressed man.
And the other guy was, yes.
The guy who owned the motel was kind of an overweight, frumpy kind of guy. And I liked that he would insist that they dress up anytime that they met. So if he was to go to if the writer guy was going to their house or whatever, he would insist on them wearing like their Sunday best kind of thing. I thought that was kind of funny.
For a lot of the time, Gerald had the hair completely dyed. Like, he's an 80-something-year-old man, and the hair was thinning extraordinarily, but it was still jet fucking black. Didn't it? You know, it was vigorous head of hair on that 80-year-old gentleman. What I thought was interesting is that the journalist from New York, there was clearly a bit of him that was somehow getting off on the stuff he did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He couldn't just report on weird sex people. He had to go and have weird sex with the weird sex people. When Foose wrote him in the early 80s, he said, he took me in and he let me watch a couple having sex in one of the rooms. I was there. I saw it. I know the hotel existed like that. So he didn't really do any further checking. He didn't sort of check the deeds. He didn't bother checking because I was there and I saw it. But to what extent did he see what Gerald told him was there, and rather than seeing what was actually there? Was this like Gerald had this sort of thing where he threw a couple of planks across the fucking rafters one night and said, we'll get this guy from New York down and look in through the fucking...
It's a lot. But they had a correspondence before your man ever came down to the motel, though, right? They were writing back and forth for a while.
My impression was him going to the hotel was pretty early. Now, they continued that correspondence for like 30 years after the fact. But my impression was the guy wrote him and said, I have this crazy setup in my hotel. And Gay was like, all right, give us a look. And then they kept in touch after that. Gay was a guy who he had a lot of, like you say, in dapper suits. He was a dapper man, a dapper Italian chap from New York. Like, he greets them. Do you remember when he went to their house? He kisses them on both cheeks to meet him. And he's an old fashioned dapper gent.
An enviable, apartment there. He lives on like a brownstone in Manhattan. I'm sure it's like rent controlled or whatever. Like, you know, he's probably paying the same rent he was paying in 1968.
Now, how does rent control work? That's something I hear constantly in things about New York.
I don't know for sure, but it's got something to do with the rent not changing, regardless of inflation or whatever. Like, you know,
I don't really know how it works either. I just hear it on Seinfeld and 30 Rock and things like that. That's all anybody wants to talk about in New York is what's rent control and what's not. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? But they tried to introduce that here, didn't they? Have they introduced it?
It's gonna be so fucking hard for people like we did in our 20s to just rent a dump and live in it while you figure shit out. Like, you know,
I lived in a place in my 20s, for most of my 20s, for a long time, that was converted by two teachers. It was a wee fucking bungalow. It wasn't even a bungalow. It was a wee sort of terrace place that they did over one summer, did a I suppose an attic conversion and built out the back. built out the back of it. It was the weirdest shaped house you would find. You were in it many a time. I had good times in that house. Yeah. Who's going to do that now?
Remember, you used to, the whole wall was just videos. Like, you know, you were buying every sort of like Euro video for it. Well, and I remember going, this is not something to be proud of, but I remember going over and seeing, I don't know, I was in Dundalk for a few days and I went over to see you and I saw a shelf full of videos. And one of them was, I think it was called Love, Honor and Obey. It was like a British gangster film that Noel Gallagher wrote music for. And I just said to you, I said, do you know, I read a review of that and apparently Denise Van Outen fillets a cucumber in that film. And we watched it, just for waiting on that scene to come up.
I have no recollection of that.
I think we were both like, that seems like a good enough reason to watch it. Like, you know...
And it seems like a good enough reason for me now. Like, I'm going to Google that as soon as this episode's over.
It's not, it doesn't sound as good as that. I remember when we got to it, it was a pretty disappointing scene. Like, you know.
I wonder what Denise Van Outen's doing now. When was the last time you saw Denise Van Outen?
It's that film, probably. Like, you know, I don't.
It ended
last
her career.
Last time I saw you, you were flating the cucumber.
I remember you. It was a nature flating the cucumber. Oh, just that was wild. That was a wild name. Abby Titmuss, you remember Abby Titmuss?
Yeah, I do.
She married a millionaire, I believe. An American millionaire.
What did she present? Or what was her story?
I remember her. She was on, I don't know, Fuck Lagoon or whatever. One of those kind of things. And there was a fella from some boy band, Blue. They were a boy band.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm possibly defaming a member of Blue.
Was that them? When the rainy days are dying. Maybe that was Five.
Oh, yeah. Could have been somebody from Five. I don't know.
Five.
It was one of those.
Where the first letter of Five was a number five, and then IVE.
Five Ive. Do you mean Five Ive?
I've been calling him Five Ive all this time.
He was on it and he clearly had an eye for her and she was not interested because he was a fucking idiot. And she had her, she was like, I'm doing this like I'm marrying my American millionaire, sir. Thank you very much. But that lady's head was screwed on. There was one absolutely gruesome scene where she wanted nothing to do with him, but he followed her around and he kept on at it all night and he got in the bed with her. And she just sort of curled up with the blankets around her and her back to him. And he sort of snuggled in beside her and literally just dry humped her through the blanket. Just dry humped her on camera.
Oh, Five Ive.
This was on camera. Five Ive. I don't know if it was a guy from Five. It could have been a guy from Five. Could have been a guy from Blue. Could have been a guy from wherever. Could have been a guy from East fucking Enders. I don't know. He was just a gobshite. He was just a gobshite and he was very drunk and he did a very silly, foolish thing. But his major problem was he did it on camera and then it got broadcast internationally.
Did she just pretend she was asleep? Like, and he just...
Basically.
Reached completion and then fell asleep himself. Like,
Jesus Christ, I hope he didn't reach completion.
Well, they wouldn't show that on the show, I guess, like, even if he did.
No.
Speaking of reaching completion, Foyer...
How do you reach completion when you're trying desperately not to move on the ceiling of a hotel?
Well, that was didn't he say that? Like, where he said, like, well, you can only really masturbate 3 or 4 times in one night, and then after that, you know, you're really just watching. Or he said something along those lines.
God be with the days. It was a strange one. But funny enough, those reality show things are very voyeuristic. And I was a big fan of early Big Brother. I got very bored with Big Brother when they started deliberately packing it with lunatics. Do you remember?
Yeah, I did watch a few of those early years, I think.
Yeah, they were very good. And the big moments were always the things that made the big headlines. But kind of the things that made the big moments was the sort of quiet stuff where you're just sort of sitting watching people. And I think they kind of lost that idea in later years. They were like, oh, we just have loads of big moments.
They showed it around the clock at one point. You come in from the pub and stick it on and they'd be in bed or whatever. And you might, well, just leave it on for 10 minutes and see does anything happen. Like,
they called poor Rish out 1 year. Do you remember that? He was the Irish fella, the token paddy 1 year. And he was having a mighty time at some stage with one of the girls. You know, they're on fucking telly. So what the fuck? He went to bed and he just clearly had a wank. And it was under the duvet, like, oh, he had to wrap himself in the duvet and walk to the toilet. It was so embarrassing. But then what Dermot O'Leary said it on Big Brother's Little Brother, it was like, we can't show, when he came out, like, we can't show any of that stuff. If you had just thrown the duvet off and wanked in front of the camera, we would never have been able to show it.
I'm not big on those kind of big, you know, those kind of seismic sort of entertainment events that everybody gets in on. I'm not great with those. I tend to be like, I don't want to watch that. You know, like the Sopranos. I remember seeing a couple of episodes of The Sopranos and thinking, I mean, I like it, but it's like nearly an hour. It used to be on network too. And I remember watching the first couple and being like, I could watch this every week. But I mean, like, you forget one week and then the next week you're like, I'm not sure what's happening now. And then I was just out. Like, you know, and then there was lots of Sopranos that I didn't see. Like, you know, I was always behind on those kind of big cultural events. You know, that was like one of the first things people would have binged though, right? When the DVDs came out. I probably mentioned it here before, but I remember getting one of the Seinfeld sets, I don't know which one it was, and it had two seasons in it, and I had the apartment to myself that I was living in for 3 days or something like that, and I think I watched the whole thing in those 3 days. I got to the point where the theme tune was making me feel sick, like I wasn't even enjoying it. It was like fucking Clockwork Orange, like, you know, it's...
30 Rock for years, I just had on in the background whenever, you know, yeah,
that's a good one to have on in the background. I think we talked about this, but I think of 30 Rock as being really like The Simpsons. I think it's like a Simpsons with people in it, like, you know, as opposed to cartoons.
There's too much of that.
What do you mean?
There's too much gag comedy. The art of the really genuinely good situation comedy, I think, has been a wee bit lost.
Well, people forget about the sit part. Like, generally speaking, the situation is half of the thing. I used to think sitcom was called that because you would sit down and watch it. When I was young. I honestly did. I was like, the whole family sits down.
Sitcom and stand up.
Yeah. You sit for the calm and you stand for the up. It's perfect.
Porridge. I fucking love porridge. I love
I started watching it not recently. I remember when you and I
we swapped one time, yeah.
We did swap an episode, but it was on Netflix and I started watching it, and Kat kind of makes fun of me sometimes because she was saying that, like, I hate it when you pick because it's always some grim looking comedy from the 70s, like, you know, because all those British comedies from the 70s, like, and the 80s, they are all in fairly sort of fucking grim locations. Like, it's just like a shit, like, you know, like the apartment in Only Fools and Horses, like, it is a bit basic, like, you know. Porridge is in a fucking prison, like, you know.
Look, I've said this before, Porridge is probably my favorite sitcom. I think of Ronnie Barker as Fletch. And it's only when I was a grown man that I realized Fletch is like a tiny sliver of this enormous career that was totally unlike Fletch.
Yeah.
Fletch was a totally different thing to what he normally did. And when they went to write their own kind of things, I loved their other style. They did the Commitments film. They adapted the Commitments to film.
Did you watch those Barrytown documentaries that were on RTE?
No, when were they?
They did like three. They did an episode about each book, each film. Like, you know, it's probably on the RTE player.
He was on. Did you hear? Did you see him on Tommy Tiernan?
No, I didn't see him.
He told this brilliant, brilliant story about. It was about, apparently every Friday night he meets up with a couple of mates he's known for years and years and years from back when he was teaching. And he goes in and gets a dart into Houston Street and meets them about 5:30, and they go for a few pints, and that's their Friday night. This is their Friday night ritual. So he's standing at Houston Street station and they weren't going to be there for about 15, 20 minutes. So he's like, oh, fuck it. All right. And there's a fella sort of eyeing him from across the way. And, he's sort of ignoring it, and he's sort of just waiting, maybe sort of flicking through the phone or whatever. Eventually, after like 10 minutes of eyeing him, this fella comes over to him and goes, are you Roddy Doyle? And Doyle goes, yeah, I am. Yeah, I'm Roddy Doyle. And your man looks at him and goes, so what? So what?
It is funny, but what was the next part of that conversation? Was it, can you leave me alone, please, scary man?
I don't know.
I didn't realize that he self-published The Commitments.
Did he?
Yeah, he self-published it because he said that he was writing away for ages and he couldn't get anyone to publish it. And he knew a lot of people who were financing their own like albums and their own plays and this kind of stuff. And he thought, yeah, he paid for it himself. He saved up and put it out himself. Like, you know.
Wow, I didn't know that.
It cost him like $2,000, which would have been a lot of money, like, you know, but he was...
Yeah, back in the late 80s.
Yeah, but he just saved it up and spent it and put it out himself.
I'm reading, you know what I'm reading? I'm reading the guy, The Martian's new book. The guy that wrote The Martian. He's another self-publisher, done good.
I haven't read the book, but I saw the film.
The new book is grand. But his new book, Project Hail Mary, it's out. And it's kind of interesting. It's fun ideas. It's about the sun. It's about a thing eating the sun, Dan. There's something eating the sun. We better send a man
on his own
into space.
For years. It's not the same thing again, is it?
Exactly. And he takes it all in his stride. Like, he takes it all in his stride. Oh, I suppose I'm the only one left. I'm sneering, but the ideas are great. But he's one of those, he's absolutely one of those sci-fi writers that's probably has some great concepts, but maybe delivering them is... Oh, you get that a lot in sci-fi. A lot of people love that. A lot of sci-fi people love reading that kind of stuff. So fair enough. But I'm more of a new wave guy. I'm more of a Le Guin wolf kind of guy.
I had to, I was trying to read The Fifth Head of Cerberus, and I read the first, we read it for the podcast before, but I read it again, yeah. But that second part, man, I just was like, I was having real trouble with it. It's just not the kind of thing I'm used to reading, and I was like getting really lost, you know, like.
It's no use to you now, but that opening movement of the second part of Fifth Head of Cerberus, I used to read that to women. There's a tip. Any young single fellas listening to this podcast, get The Fifth Head of Cerberus and read them.
Oh,
that opening, that opening chapter of the second novella.
When she isn't this the start with a birth?
Yeah, cedar branches waving lived in the country of the sliding stones, and it came to her as it came to women, as it comes to women.
Did it work?
That's a callow way to phrase that question.
Yeah, you were reading an antonym for callow reasons, so tell me, did it work?
Well, no, it wasn't, because I am looking for some kind of profound spiritual connection. That's all I've ever spent my entire life looking for. I'll tell you this. It didn't hurt. Okay. Couldn't have hurt, like. I wasn't in a situation where, well, this will be the end of it then. You know, that was not going to be the weirdest fucking thing they were going to have to forgive, basically. My knob's not a weird shape or anything. I want to make that clear to everybody listening to the podcast. I have a perfectly normal penis. There's nothing. It's not like shaped like a T-Rex or a chicken nugget or something. It's not.
Chicken nugget. Some chicken nuggets look like penises.
I think you're thinking of a goujon, Dan.
Oh, man.
Anyway, do you know who's seen his fair share of penises? Gerald Foos.
Oh, no, you don't.
Oh, I did do that. Penises and fannies and murders and drugs and a full bucket of KFC.
One night he saw a lad reading The Fifth Head of Cerberus to a bored woman.
You don't do it to everyone. You want to make sure that she's... Make sure that she's going to be able to appreciate the profundity that you're going to lay down.
Honest to God, I was reading that going, oh man, I think this is above me. I couldn't visualize it. Like, I was like, I don't know what's going on. And I got to he goes adventuring and he meets people. And that's when I was just like, I can't make head nor tail of this.
When you get to the end of the third one, on maybe your third read, you suddenly kind of be like, oh my God. Because you get to the end of the first one and you think you've seen the fucking trick. And you're like, oh, I get it. So he was he was pretending he replaced the dude. Okay, all right. And then you read the second time and you're going, yeah, but why? Those fucking shadow children don't kind of make sense in that respect. And then you read it the third time and you're like, oh my God, it's not that he replaced him. It's that this whole thing, and it's not... What you think when I say that, people will go, oh, so they replaced all the humans and they're all real. No, that's not what it is. I don't want to fucking give it away, but it's there in the book if you read it.
I really want to finish it because it was just I almost feel it's like, I don't know, I've made you like listen to so many fucking stupid albums down through the years on this that I just felt like I owed it to you to read it. Like, you know,
some of those albums I loved, they weren't all Piper at the Gates of Dawn.
Oh, I didn't think you listened to that. I forgot about that.
That's a burn. I'm still remembering that. That must be 7 or 8 years ago now, is it?
Sitting in an eiderdown. Yippee, you can't see me, but I can see you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a Pink Floyd guy. But Jarrell Foos, I found them, man. Listen, the thing is, I know all those publisher guys were very concerned that people would have a moral objection. And of course, there is a moral objection to doing what Jarrell Foos claims he did. I don't necessarily buy that he did it.
But why did he go to the bother of contacting your man if he didn't do it?
I think he's a very lonely man.
He's married to that woman who...
Anita.
He just seems to be like looking out windows the whole time, okay, going, it's very dark
in
here.
You're the fucking socially acceptable face of the Swap Meet podcast. But if anybody had seen the look on your face when you went, he's married to that.
No, I didn't mean it like that. Lady. I meant like when they have a house somewhere in, where are they?
A lovely house, by the way. He's doing house, well.
It's a lovely house, but there's a bit in it where he's going, yeah, we don't really socialize and we don't have any friends or anything. That's the way we like it. And you could see her just going, I need to talk to someone. You can see it in her eyes. She's just like staring out the window, like, you know. And
yeah, but didn't he need it as well? And doesn't it seem like it might be the case that all of this is a way for him to just connect to the outside world?
I don't know, like,
because he's really up on gay. He's really up on the journalist Gay Talese. He really wants to be part of that sort of New York City dapper gent sort of jet set, that intelligentsia. I think by telling these stories, he was creating a connection to the world that he didn't really have. And maybe, if they're true, by watching that world, he was kind of creating a connection to the world that he didn't really have. If you asked me to put money on it, my feeling would be he made this up in order to create that connection.
If someone were to push you for an explanation, you would say he probably didn't do any of this stuff. Or no, but he did. He took your man to a hotel, whether he owned it or not.
And the guy could look in and see, yeah, Gay Talese. Yeah, so I would have to believe Gay was a liar in order to discount that. And I don't think I do. But I think in the dark upstairs, a couple of planks thrown across some rafters might seem perfectly much like an elaborate fucking voyeur construction.
Because they made it sound really fucking
elaborate.
Yeah, like there was like places for him to relax and stuff. Like, wasn't there like a little office where he could go in? That's probably where he wrote the journals or whatever. The journals were the weirdest part of it to me, because a lot of work went into those journals, and it seems like a lot of it was fucking fiction.
But here's the thing. I think, like, there's this bit where Gay goes, okay, now coming up to the release of the book, they'll have to be babysat. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to babysit them. I don't know if he was being 100% honest with himself, is the honest to God truth. I mean, he's getting something out of it too. And it's not just reportage.
Do you think, because he was very quick to disown the book. Like, what happens is it comes out that your man, just as the book gets released, it comes out that there was a discrepancy with the dates that he claimed to have owned the hotel or whatever. And he just seems to like immediately disown the book. It's just like, that's it. The book's dead. That's it. It's done. I don't want to hear about it ever again. And then it seems like 2 weeks later or something, he's on Seth Meyers and it's all fine again. I just thought he was like, was he almost kind of, by the time the book came out, was he sort of thinking maybe he shouldn't have bothered? Like, you know, there was something about, he was really ready to drop that book. He didn't like, it was almost like he was looking for an excuse to disown it.
I think he had that book in the late 70s or the 80s, the neighbor's wife book, the sex book, where he could reasonably have been accused of something other than simple fucking fact stating. I don't think you need to join in the orgy to report that an orgy's happening. And I think he'd left himself open to that. And then here comes the voyeur's motel, and he's left himself open to the same thing. He said he went in there with a guy, he watched a couple have sex, and his tie was hanging out the vent.
Yeah, this is a funny story, yeah. But you think you would have noticed that.
You also think, what an extraordinary bit of color. If I was writing a novel, wouldn't that be a wonderful...
Yeah, good point.
It's like Robert De Niro's gun catching fire when he assassinates Finucci in The Godfather 2. It's like, oh, what a wonderfully memorable little grace note. I doubt he was lying. I think it's more likely that Jarrell Foos threw a couple of planks across the rafters in his hotel, let Gay Talese look in through a fucking vent in the ceiling at a couple, and Gay Talese believed every story Gerald Foos spun from that after that. He gave him years of fucking of journal entries. Like, that's the killer. That's the kicker. Because his journals start like 3 years before he owned the motel. And he says, oh, well, maybe I got the 6 and the 9 round the wrong way. What?
Oh, yeah.
You got the 6 and the 9 the wrong way.
You see, I draw my 6s upside down. So that's probably what happened there. Like, but you didn't get the 6 for the 60 wrong. If that was the case, it would have been 1999, like not, or even 1699. Like, it wouldn't have been, you know, it wouldn't have made any sense. Yeah. Like, you know.
But also, it's like, okay, you can do that as a typo. Then some of them would be right and some of them would be wrong. But you can't consistently have 66 absolutely. To 69.
I forgot about that. Yeah, that's nonsense. Absolutely nonsense.
And Talese goes really mental when your man brings that up. Do you remember that part of the interview?
I did what I wanted to do. I didn't do what you want me. I did what I want to do. I said, it's my right. Go ahead and blab to the public.
It was your right, because I think we had a contract.
We both have a right. You have a right to criticize me, and they don't have a right to ask you the same question. You're going to sanitize it. Let's make what you said. I didn't hear it.
Talese was like, why are you asking him that? You want him to react differently now because I'm here. He's entitled to think I'm and it's like, okay, right. We know why you're fucking going mental, gay. It's because the explanation he has given you is bullshit. You know it's bullshit. And anybody touching on the bullshit explanation is going to be causing you issues. It's a weird one.
And there was that weird moment where your man, what's his name, Gay, he does an interview with some, was it the New York Times? Or maybe he's on...
Yeah.
Maybe it's when he's on Seth Meyers. No, the Seth Meyers is after the book comes out. He mentions your man's baseball card collection.
I never wanted that in there. I don't want people to know that I got $1 million card collection here. What if a lawyer turns around and sues me and they put a lock on the house and everything in it? I can't even sell it, because the reason they put a lock on it is they know it's worth millions and therefore they can get the money. See? God, what the... And I never saw any of those things. Never once did he ever show me the damn manuscript. Get that out of there. You know, you don't put that kind of stuff in there. You don't write about a man's money. I mean, I'm really mad at the Gay. I'm mad as hell at him.
So I think the film itself, I think when it got to the end, I was a little bit disappointed, because I thought it was maybe leading to something a bit more revelatory than what we got, you know. Would you read the book?
I kind of want to know, yeah.
I just want to see how he put it together. And why did they put a book and a documentary out at the same time? It seems like...
Yeah, but they were filming it coming up to it, like, yeah.
Yeah, it just seemed like a weird move to make the documentary in the first place if the book was already out, you know?
You see, now, here's the thing. You say that there wasn't much of a payoff for you. I think I kind of did get a payoff, in the sense that...
That's because you're a voyeur. You're looking for the payoff.
Dan, sometimes it's just as... I don't know where I was going.
Yeah, I was waiting to see.
I think kind of the payoff for me was that Gay Talese went through the whole film really talking down about this guy, about how he was worried that he'd say the wrong thing, or he doesn't know whether to believe him or not. It's all strange, and he was going to have to go and handhold him, make sure he didn't, you know, let anything out while he was doing the thing, while he was, you know, coming up to the release of the book. And then at the end, it sort of seemed like he'd been had to me, that he'd followed his own sort of voyeuristic instincts, or the word isn't voyeurism for Talese. He's looking to join things. He gets some kind of thrill out of being part of a thing, I think. He let a guy who was maybe not 110% honest lead him down a merry path that was maybe not 110% true. So look, it's a true story. So, and by the way, Foos has died. And when I was looking up stuff about
he's
it, yes,
dead,
he has passed. He has passed away.
That must be recently. Now, it's not an old film, right?
Yeah, it's 2017. Yeah. So it's fairly recent, but it's not as if he looked the picture of health in it or anything.
Well, like that, no, he's in a fucking one of those chairlifts and stuff, like, you know.
But that house was lovely. I wouldn't bet against his collection of sports memorabilia being worth something.
But he must have been doing something to make money. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, because he had the hotel at that point, like, you know.
Yeah, he had, you don't live in a house like that. Well, who the fuck knows? Well, you were there. Maybe in the central plains of America, land is cheap and every house is a mansion.
Houses are bigger, for sure. But, I mean, that was one thing. Because I have stayed in a couple of motels and I was watching it thinking, God, the whole time I was in a motel, I was just like, all right, so I assume we probably get shot around 11 o'clock. Does that sound about right? Like, you know, so I wasn't in any kind of mood to be having sex in the motel. Like, you know, and every little grate and stuff, I was like clocking it. Like, and that was a, you know, just.
Really?
Yeah. And it was just like a little franchise place. It was one of the most, I remember we were, it was a motel. I think they were called a Motel 6. We went to Detroit. Stayed in a motel right. in Detroit of all fucking places. Like, you know, and.
That sounds Motor City. That sounds cool.
Well, we were thinking of moving to Detroit at one point, and someone told us to check out an area called Corktown, which we went to. It turned out it was the Irish part of Detroit. It was all Irish bars and stuff.
So it's Cork as in Corktown.
It's basically Corktown. And I was talking to a guy. It was the middle of the afternoon in a bar, like an older guy. And he was saying, like, oh, you're Irish. And the people were nuts about Irish stuff. And he was saying... Well, we went to Dublin for St. Patrick's Day, and we were really disappointed because all the pubs we went into, there was just no Irish music playing. Like, and it's just like, and I was going, yeah, but we don't.
It's all Nickelback.
Yeah, well, this is it. I was just saying, well, look.
On my two Nickelback.
My point was kind of like, well, I've been here for a few days and I haven't heard any Motown, like, you know, so it's just like. It's the same thing. Like, we don't walk around listening to traditional music all the time. We listen to the fucking same shit that everybody else does. Like, you know, when Irish people go out, they do like to hear some Irish music, but they also like to hear "Tonight's Gonna Be a Good Night." You know, they want to.
Chumbawamba.
Chumbawamba, yeah.
I get no time, but I'll get up again.
We just like
they
like
were this. Fucking crazy. Am I right in saying Chumbawamba were more some kind of? Like anarcho-communist syndicate than a band.
I couldn't hum you another Chumbawamba song, but the hit was kind of an accident. Like, you know, they were doing shit for years. Like, they were one of these sort of anarchic punk bands for years. Now, I don't know what any of that stuff sounds like. It sounds like an awful lot of work went into making that song sound commercial, like, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things where it's like, well, this isn't about anything anarchic except someone who drinks a lot. You know, whiskey drink, a vodka drink, a cider drink, you know. And
then
there's a bit of Danny Boy in it for some reason. I didn't really...
Oh, Danny Boy. Danny
is it a good song?
Boy.
It's not really, is it?
I like it. Makes me happy. That's all I need. As long as I have Chumbawamba... And maybe a wee sup of the
as long as I have a bit of happiness, I'm happy enough.
I like that song. What can I tell you, Dan? I think it's fun. I think it's a fun song.
I suppose, like, but I never. Oh God, it's 10:30. I better be wrapping things up a little bit.
Fucking it, Dan. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I got giddy as fuck. I don't know why that is. Yeah. So that's my philosophy. My philosophy is we should all be voyeurs and. Sometimes it's good to see a New York yuppie taking down a peg. That I think is the moral of the story. I got nothing against New York yuppies. I'm sure they're wonderful people, many of them. I'm sure Gay Talese is grand, but there was an itch he was scratching, and Gerald Foose held out the opportunity for him to scratch it, and he took it way too seriously.
Yeah, I think he might be right. So I was thinking. I have two things in mind to do for the next podcast, one of which I've seen.
You always have two things in mind.
I know, yeah. One of which I've seen and one of which I haven't seen. And I'm going to give you the choice.
Let's do the haven't.
Okay, you might, you don't get too excited. You're doing your sort of like the kind of finger movements people make when they see a turkey coming out of the oven, like, you know.
Turkey.
The first one I was thinking was Performance, the film with Mick Jagger in it.
Oh, I do like a bit of Mick Jagger.
Well, this is why I'm going to give you the choice. So don't jump to the thing I haven't seen too quickly because you might be more intrigued.
Okay.
I watched Performance. Okay. I haven't had the DVD for years. I watched it recently and I enjoyed it. But
all right.
There's a movie on YouTube called Head, and it's basically The Monkees.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Monkees made a film in the late 60s that was like their attempt to break free from their image, like their sort of pop image.
Like The Monkees, Davy Jones and The Monkees Mike Nesbitt.
Two E's, three E's, two E's.
Hey, Hey Were the Monkees.
Hey, Hey Were the Monkees, yeah.
Not a David Attenborough thing.
It's kind of, no, it's The Monkees. And it's kind of like an arty, I've never seen it. This is the thing. I actually had the DVD for years and I never watched it, but I've always been intrigued by it. It's co-written by a very young Jack Nicholson.
Dan, listen to me. Come here, fuck this then. Listen, there's always time for Jagger. We'll get back around to Jagger. I have no problem with that. I'll fuck it. Jagger is eternally youthful and we'll never, it's never a wrong time for Jagger. But right now, what I want to see is The Monkees conceptual art piece co-helmed by Jack Nicholson.
Fair enough then. So it's, the film is called Head, as in H-E-A-D. It's on YouTube.
As in giving me head in the unmade bed while the limousines wait in the street.
Apparently the reason they called it Head is because if they made a second film, they wanted to have the tagline brought by the people who gave you head.
That's
it's a long con, but there was no second film, so it, you know, but
that's like, didn't Adrian Edmondson and Rick Mayall call Bottom Bottom so that the continuity announcers, because they originally wanted to call it My Bottom,
yeah
so that the continuity announcers would have to say, now it's time for My Bottom.
I keep meaning to watch Bottom. Do you know what? Very quickly, what I heard about Bottom is that when they made that,
go on.
The two of them had just starred in a run of Waiting for Godot in some theater in London, and Bottom is supposedly like a sort of a Young Ones-esque like extension of that. So that's why there's only two of them in a flat. Like, you know, it's semi-based on Waiting for Godot, which is weird when you think of it, because it's just two lads fucking poking each other in the eye and farting for half an hour. Like, you know.
Well, I can see that. I think. Look, I've said this in this podcast before. I think the worst thing that happened to Beckett were the fans of Beckett. I think there's a lot of that in Beckett, and people don't doesn't register with people that much. I do know a guy, Alton Hodgers, who's been on this very podcast, who has the theory that Fools and Horses is basically The Plough and the Stars in London.
All those guys those writers back then, they weren't just TV writers. We've talked about this before. They were people with lives, and they weren't just really basing their stuff on other television. They were had all sorts of influences, but Head by the Monkees.
Sorry, you have to let go. Yeah, you have to go.
It's on YouTube. If you want to watch along, free. You can watch. You don't have to rent it or anything. You can watch it on YouTube for nothing. So that's
this could be dreadful.
Yeah, I've fallen asleep trying to watch it twice now. Like, you know.
Oh no!
But the first track in it, like Mickey Dolenz dives into like a red ocean and he's swimming around and there's this fucking amazing song playing. So I'm
walking around.
I definitely want to check it out, but. Anyway, that's it for another episode. Niall's getting into the Monkees theme tune there. It's not in the film.
The Monkees.
Oh, shite.
Well, they can't make a serious break from their image, and then the start of it is, here we come.
Oh, this is a serious break from their image.
Did I not say that?
Possibly.
This is them trying not to be the Monkees anymore.
Oh, no, that's...
It's too late now, Niall. I'm not doing a whole spiel about performance now. We're stuck with it.
go.
It's like fucking 90 minutes. You'll be grand. So thanks very much for listening to this week's episode, and we'll catch you all again very shortly. Cheerio.
Bye bye.
Tree and Tom in the road. Everywhere you go, we just